Welcome to AIGA's Fireside Chat. This is day two of the 2022 AIGA Design and Business Conference. Thank you for joining us for this fireside and for the conference. Please connect with us and share your thoughts. The hashtags are AIGA Design, AIGA DBCONF. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome Vinny F. Johnson, AIGA's Executive Director, and today's guest, Michael Beirut, Partner at Pentagram. Benny?
Thank you, Amy. And good morning and welcome, everyone. Really, as you said, greetings. We have guests joining us from all around the globe, which is really exciting for our day two of the AIGA 2022 Design and Business Conference. This conference is a unique opportunity for us to look at the power of design as it intersects with business and the world around us. This is a really special conversation. Our guest today needs no introduction, but that's why I'm going to give him an introduction so that you can understand the presence, the passion, and the magnitude my guest today has had on design and our larger design business community. Our guest today is Michael Beirut, partner of Pentagram. Michael Beirut is a graphic designer extraordinaire, a design critic, an educator, a servant leader in his profession. He's an AIGA medalist and served both as president of our New York chapter and president emeritus of AIGA National. He has served in several leading organizations in helping to push design, business, and culture forward. He's been a part of the Cooper Hewitt National Design Awards, and he's been the Henry Wolf resident in graphic design at the American Academy in Rome. Serving as a senior critic in graphic design at Yale, he's lectured on the practice of design and management, both at Yale School of Art and the Yale School of Management. He's the co-founder of the website Design Observer, and has written numerous volumes. His monograph that we'll talk about a little bit today is simply entitled, what I love, How to Use Graphic Design to Sell Things, Explain Things, Make Things Look Better, Make People Laugh, Make People Cry, and Every Once in a While Change the World. Today, I'd like to welcome my friend, Michael Beirut. Welcome to the fireside.
Hi, Benny. Happy to be here. Happy to be here with everyone.
Well, it's really great when we talk about kind of leadership and service for a community. You know, it's incredible just over the years, your commitment, your name always pops up. And even this morning, our friend Cheryl Heller, our last medalist, mentioned in a quote, she shared online a photo and an article of your service on AIG's very first diversity task force. Yeah. And this was some almost 40 years ago. And we talk about, you know, showing up in leadership in action. And it was a great reminder that Cheryl gave all of us. But to talk about, you know, what service has meant to you in the profession. I'd like to start off a little different than we talked before, but I'd love to start off with that, about how you've come to feel about your role in helping the industry.
Benny, thanks for that kind introduction and for that question. I think one of, it's interesting. I've one of the things that has always motivated me as a designer, and I think as a person who works as a designer, is both my sense that I'm really privileged in a lot of different ways, but privileged in a way that perhaps is shared by many of the people on this call, in that I discovered early on that there was something that I loved to do, that I was good at, and then found that I could make a life doing that thing. And, you know, people will define that in different ways. For someone in my generation, it was probably finding you were good at doing something like drawing and creating art, right. And then discovering there was that you didn't have to do that on Saturdays. You could actually not only do it, you know, as a job for a living, but also do it in a way that could affect the lives of other people, that could enter their worlds in different ways. But I also, when I made that discovery back in, you know, ancient history times, back in the 60s and 70s in suburban Cleveland, I was surrounded and no one around me was doing that. You know, I mean, they could sort of appreciate a kid who knew how to draw, but like the idea that,
right,
you know, that there was some, you could make a living doing something other than working in the Ford plant or, you know, working in a barber shop or a butcher shop or something like that. Or being something that kind of was, you know, like a doctor or a lawyer, you know, professions that would show up in picture books. You know, no one knew anything about like the idea of, you know, working as a professional, quote unquote, graphic designer. And, you know, a lot of things that motivate me, you know, have always been my remembering what it was like being surrounded by people who sort of didn't understand or care that much about the things that I was passionate about, and my desire to kind of open up those worlds to them. So I think one of the things that I got almost good at by necessity was explaining what design was in terms that non-designers could understand. I'm married to a non-designer. My mom and dad were non-designers. My three adult children are all non-designers. So I'm hemmed in on all sides by people who not only, you know, they understand what I do, they're actually very healthily skeptical about what I do. They're my fiercest critics. They will sort of, you know, I've got my famous younger daughter has often said, "You're doing that thing you always do, Dad, where you're taking something, tweaking it, and saying, 'There, I fixed it for you.'" I'm in the process right now of designing her wedding invitations. So, you know,
you've taken that role on as both dad and designer.
Yeah.
I think I should give you credit for that, but I don't know.
Yeah. Either credit or sympathy, whatever you want. But I do think that, part of what my journey was in a way, interestingly enough, this is going to sound oxymoronically like bragging, but I think the older I've gotten, the more humility I've acquired about the role that people who do what we do play. You know, when I first graduated from design school, I sort of thought, you know, why doesn't the world know or care about this thing that I spent 5 years studying? There's something wrong with them. And it's my job to go out there and just bang their heads together till they really realize what a genius, you know, I and my colleagues are, and that we kind of possess these special gifts. And then you really realize that you have to reach people that, you know, that's, you know, preaching at them and kind of looking down at them and, you know, kind of trying to quote unquote, you know, to teach them about the importance of design. You have to like live it and demonstrate it and do it in ways that are relevant to their lives and the way that they live, and be prepared to fail, be prepared to be misunderstood, be prepared to listen to people as they're telling you what reactions they're having or not to the work that you're doing. You know, and I think, you know, learning how to listen and learning how to learn from that has been probably the thing that actually made the biggest difference for me. And the thing, in fact, that I got out of that service, it's funny, I remember really clearly what a revelation that conference was that Cheryl was talking about, that very first Wives Graphic Design 98% White conference that I think must have happened maybe in the early 90s or so. It was a long time ago. And it was just revelatory to me. It really was. I can remember where I was sitting in that room. I remember, you know, how the chair felt under my butt. I really have a really keen muscle set of memory of that event. And again, it was a learning experience, not a, you know, not a platform for me certainly, but it's just a place for me to enlarge my own view about what, you know, what role our profession could play in advancing the world at large.
So, you know, what's interesting for me is when you talk about, you know, being in Ohio and studying graphic design and being in Cincinnati, there were people around you who created kind of pathways for you, who were mentors. And it's keen to see that you've adopted that same role for many other people kind of spacing in there. But take me back to Cincinnati. You know, when you were there, what did success look like for you? What did you think success would be when you were studying graphic design in Cincinnati and in your early days?
I had a dangerously narrow view of success. You know, I mean, I think hidden away in my attic somewhere is a journal from this that I kept back in the 70s in high school through college, right? I, God help me. I think somewhere in there in my, you know, teenage handwriting are the words, you know, I want to be a famous graphic designer. And this is like, you know, and also I just wanted to qualify that and make it sound not quite so stupid or embarrassing. You know, no one had ever heard of famous graphic designers back then. You know, the one, oddly, Benny, I can't even figure out how I came to know what their names were pre-internet. You know, I think, right. You know, Milton Glaser had just published a book called Milton Glaser Graphic Design that my mom, God bless her, managed to find at a downtown department store in Cleveland and give it to me as a Christmas present. And right. So, you know, Milton Glaser was the most famous graphic designer in the world to me. And I just like wanted to do what he did. And I just, you know, I think what my biggest dream was, if someone was standing in a record store flipping through covers, you know, they would come to one that I had designed and turn it over and think, this is cool. I want to buy this record. And, you know, because that had happened to me many times. And I knew the names of record cover designers as much as I knew the names of the people playing instruments.
Right.
You know, that's how nerdy I was. I want to be one of those guys. Like, sort of like, you know, I can't play an instrument, but you can sort of be, you can say, hey, I'm with the band. I designed their cover. And that was close enough for me. I think that was sort of what success looked like. So if that's my measure of success, I'll point out that I've never designed a record cover or even a CD cover or an MP3 cover or anything like that. Unlike my partner, Paula Scher, who will, you know, who knows that her obituary will say Paula Scher, famous designer of Boston's first debut album, cover. You know, she lives in constant dread of that, famously. So I live vicariously through her as far as that goes.
There you go. So skip ahead. I'm going to keep on this theme of thinking about success. So now we move to the early 90s and you're at Pentagram. What was your definition of success then?
Well, I think I really, I may have kind of had a, what's the word for it? A kind of a, like I was a little bit of a late bloomer. I sort of had a delayed maturity in a way, because in between graduation and joining Pentagram, I worked for 10 years for, you know, probably the key mentor I had in my life, Massimo Vignelli, a legendary designer who was, you know, president of AIGA, president of AGI, sort of like one of those names that I knew, and who was a hero and role model of mine. And who ran an office very much like an atelier in a way that I think probably is almost, a historic model that's not really operant anymore. Right. You know, you'd virtually apprentice yourself to a man mm-hmm. like Vignelli and learn the trade through that process. Right. And when I joined Pentagram at the end of that arc, you know, my goal was just to figure out what my design handwriting was, what kinds of things right. I was interested in. And Benny, if I made one misapprehension I had that I think would still be relevant to anyone listening now, is that I remember thinking, I want to figure out what my kind of visual design style is. I would look at designers who I admire and I would think, you know, you can tell a Milton Glaser, you can tell an April Grimen, you can tell a Paula Scher, you know, by the typefaces they used and their color sense and what their, you know, what kind of, visual tropes they incorporated into their work.
Right.
And I thought it's my responsibility now to develop a set of things that people would say, oh, you can always tell a Michael Leroux design. Right. And instead, that's the wrong way to do it. The thing that I realized was, what you need to do is just find out what subjects you're interested in. What are you curious about? What excites you? What people, you know, if you're in a room with someone, where do you, you know, where can you draw the energy and inspiration from those people? And when, how can you contribute to that energy and inspiration? So it's got almost nothing to, like, you sort of can't force the, thinking about the work is important, but thinking about kind of that craft as the starting point, for me at least, it was just sort of like, it just got it backwards. I just kind of learned when I look back at work I had done, particularly in those days, the things that I judged as the most successful were things where I just connected with the problem with the subject. I cared about the mission of the organization. I vibe with the people who were representing it. Then there are other things where I was just sort of discharging or, you know, my responsible professional role, doing a good job. But, you know, I would look at those things and think, oh, you can really tell that's not something that I cared as much about. And I think, you know, and the lesson that I drew from that was the more things you care about, the more things you can get excited about, the more things you can be curious about, the more access you'll have to a world of things that you can participate in. You know, and some people are specialists. They just, you know, their interest is, you know, say fashion, or their interest is sports, and they sort of like, you know, kind of plow a fairly narrow road through that, which I think is perfectly valid if that's what your passion is. I've always been, you know, had a really broad, you know, capacity for spreading my attention around even too thin sometimes, right, and just ended up, I think, coming into the 90s, realizing that if I got a call from someone and they would say, can you do some graphic design for me? I would use that as an excuse to kind of, you know, go underground into their world and, right, you know, find, and so I could find myself in, you know, football locker rooms or newsrooms or, you know, scientific laboratories, you know, and without being good at sports, having taken a journalism class or, you know, getting anywhere beyond biology one, suddenly, you know, I'm in rooms where people are purporting to decode, you know, the genome so they can cure cancer, and trying to explain it to me so I can explain it to someone else who, like me, doesn't understand it, you know? Right. So that idea of kind of using it, so kind of realizing that it's not so much about picking a cool typeface, although I love a cool typeface as much as any of the 79 people on this call. That sort of is the thing that will come naturally if you can get engaged and excited and energized by the subject matter and the work and the interplay of personalities and the ambitions that everyone shares about putting something out into the world.
Right. I think it's interesting, and even in hearing your conversation, I'm seeing a throughput of this evolution of starting off where it was about you, right? It was about the designer as the, this is what I'm doing. This is my signature space. You have the similar thing in architecture or in music. You can tell a song's been produced by a producer. But the shift, even in your language and the storytelling, where it doesn't become about you, but it becomes about you diving into the client.
Yeah.
And diving into the subject matter and those interests, and ultimately that making you a better designer. And I'll extend our conversation to say also partner.
Yeah.
In moving in the work that you have. So when you, let's talk a bit about Pentagram, which is, you know, goes without saying is world's largest design organization of its type. But you're a really interesting model in the sense that you're a collection of partners, in which your partners are the owners, but they're also the drivers of the work, right?
Yeah.
Talk a bit about how, because for those who are listening and we're streaming in, our audiences in there, they're experiencing various different types of business models in spaces. Yeah. And this is a unique one in which you have this kind of ultimate partner lattice
to
build together.
Yeah. Yeah. Benny, it's a really good question. And in fact, I sort of would, in some ways it's completely unique, and I have trouble even explaining it to my partners and I will disagree about what the model really is and what the key attributes of it are sometimes. That sort of makes it interesting. But in some ways, I think it would be familiar nearly to any professional who's on this call, in that when it was started by the original five designers who began it nearly 50 years ago this June, it'll be 50 years ago in June, next month. Their idea was that, you know, they wanted to combine the virtues of a very small model of practice led by a single person working closely with some helpers, where that person, not so much because so they could have total control, I don't think, but so they could focus on engaging with the work and engaging with those things that I was talking about earlier that I find exciting, you know, so they're never put in a position where they're just managing, you know, huge groups of people. It's just kind of a handful of people, a dozen or so, let's say. And I think the what they learned was you can only go so far with that small model. And when they joined together as five and named it Pentagram after that five-sided shape that more or less described, you know, was the org chart, because none of them were the boss. They were all equals. They all preserved their autonomy. So they, you know, they would hire their own teams, pick their own clients, then pool the income and share the profits equally, share the overhead, you know, five living more cheaply than any one of them could live on their own. You know, that model became the Pentagram model. And then, you know, to the outside world, you know, a client who might be reluctant to hire any one of those five individuals because they just seemed like a lone, helpless freelancer would have more confidence with, you know, the body of work and the size of the office that, that they were able to command back then in the UK in the, 70s and going into the 80s. Today it's 23 partners, you know, in Austin, Berlin, London, and New York. Here in New York, I have 9 partners. So there are 10 of us in all. And it still works according to the same model, however. So I have, like, say, a dozen people who work on my team. We work on a lot of things independently. We're able to take on something as small as a book cover and as large as a big brand identity. But then we're able to also collaborate with each other as partners, combine our teams within offices, across offices, and work in a big open plan to encourage that sort of cross-fertilization.
It always amazes me, kind of the breadth of the work that you do, when I see it show up in these like really intimate startup small projects. And I'm thinking, there's no way in the world that Pentagram is working on this, but yet you are. And then there's these kind of big earth-shattering projects that you see that you would expect a big space in there. And I think that's there's some incredible value if we think about design and business and work that you can have that flexibility.
Yeah. And I think it's all because of this model that was set up by these five, you know, these five individuals back when I was in the ninth grade in Ohio, you know, so I had nothing to do with it, but it's remarkable how much, you know, sort of the basic precepts of the working arrangement they established then has endured, you know, half a century later. And certainly, you know, it's, there are many aspects of it that are ripe for change. Those were, you know, maybe predictably in the most tiresome possible way. Those were five white guys back then. And it was a lot of guys and a lot of white guys for a long time. And now I think we're fortunate in this office of the 10 partners, you know, half of us are women, people of color. And I think that will, that inevitably just has to kind of keep recalibrating. And, you know, it happens with the staff, it's going to happen at the partner level, it's going to happen at every level. And it doesn't happen by accident. You have to push it and be intentional about it.
In thinking of being intentional, so with 23 partners, you end up having almost 23 teams.
Yeah.
How do you create a dynamic exchange between the partners and those sub teams?
It's fairly complicated, and it's something we talk about and sometimes argue about, because it's sort of, you're kind of balancing two things that are, you know, that great nations argue about all the time.
Right.
The Supreme Court tries to figure out the difference between what should be controlled by individuals, what should be controlled by states, what should be controlled by at the national level. Right. And I think, that, you know, here in this little old partnership, you know, trying to figure out how you balance, you know, the, you know, what benefit we owe the collective and what benefit we derive from the collective versus what any one of us can do individually is, you know, that sort of has been since 1972, one of the things that they've gone back and forth about. And I think now, and I think relevant to, you know, anyone on this call, regardless of whether they were born in the 50s like me or born in the aughts or the 90s or whenever they were and wherever point they are in their career, I think one of the things that really has changed dramatically is that we are also now, you know, trying to figure out how we balance, you know, the individual ambitions and individual profiles of each of the designers that work for us, each of the designers on my team who are talented and ambitious, who have, one of the reasons that I kind of just showed up to work for Massimo Vignelli was, no one had ever heard, you know, I thought I was a great designer, but I was the only person in New York who had that opinion. Even my wife was a little bit iffy on it. But Vignelli thought I was a good enough designer to work for him, but certainly exactly that good and no better. And other than, you know, a few people, no one had heard of me. And that was going to be how it would be for years. There was no, you know, I didn't have a social media account or a website or any means of reaching the public and making my work and my voice out, putting it out there. Now we live in a world where every single one of us has that sort of access, which I think is fantastic. I think it sort of enriches, you know, it's, I think the more that the idea of creative work being something that isn't just the bailiwick of a high priesthood of people who know, who have been specially trained and who know a certain kind of jargon, but rather something where people feel they can participate in it and, you know, be curious about it, learn about it, right. You know, do it to a certain degree, even if that means the dark side of that are, you know, logos for $20 or whatever these sites are that can do that. I think that that's just part of, that's just a byproduct of having, you know, the ability to create and make things more democratically distributed. I think if we try to hog that for ourselves, it's fatal. And I think that if you manage a firm of any size, one right. of the responsibilities you have is figuring out how you nurture the people that are working for you and how you respect their voices and how you respect the, you know, how you sort of are conscious of and respect the profiles that they're building for themselves.
One of the things you shared with me that I thought was really powerful, you talked about bringing your partners together and how each year everyone shares a project that was incredibly personally meaningful for them. Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting. You're having a partnership conversation, which of course you're going to talk about profits and sharing, but your concept of sharing isn't in that the business space in there, but it's about what is the work that you've done this past year that's personally meaningful?
Yeah. So in fact, Benny, the week after next, all of us are going to be meeting together for Wednesday through Sunday to have our bi-yearly meeting where all four of the offices, the partners all come together and we spend a couple of days just socializing and spending time with each other because we all like each other. And then we spend one day generally going through the business mechanics of the partnership. And one of the things that I think is fascinating about Pentagram's model, and one of the reasons it's unique and probably dangerously unique or rightly unique, is that because it's a partnership comprised entirely of working designers, it means that it's being run by people who all went to art school, basically, you know, effectively, and further run by people who may have bailed out of math after algebra 2 or, you know, like me, that's as far as I went. I didn't take pre-calc or trig or anything. So I've got a very shaky grasp on balance sheets, particularly, and then retained earnings is something that will come up during the meeting. I still, after 30 plus years, don't quite understand what that means.
You know, it's okay, my friend, because part of the new things we're doing with AIGA, we've got courses to cover any of those.
Oh, gaps. Yeah. Sign me up. Yeah,
I can get you in to fill that gap.
But yeah. Okay. God bless you. I'm not sure, but it might ruin my, you know, it might actually, I've gotten this far just using the force, closing my eyes and kind of like waving a lightsaber around and actually paying attention to where the money's coming from, what it's doing, might actually mess up my vibe. But we get together, spend a day talking about business. And then, every day we devote part of, the days to kind of conducting like a miniature design conference, like as you said, partners will share work that was important to them in the last year or two, go into depth on a certain project, maybe just give an idea of the breadth of the work that happens, talk about challenges they were facing or problems that they had. And they're able to do it in a way that's very, can be very soul bearing in a way that's moving and inspiring. And I think we, you know, just as when I talk, you asked that great question about, what I was, you know, the transition that I went through in the 90s when I first joined Pentagram, and sort of that balance between the work that you do, that's your output, that represents sort of the visual mark you're leaving behind, and kind of the ideas behind it, the process that went into it, the human equation that both shaped what the work turned out to be and what effect that work had in the world. You know, I think we use those conversations to get into those bigger issues as well. And it's just, it's actually very daunting. I think what's comical is that, not all the partners present, at every one of these meetings. You sort of do it about every other, every third meeting. And every time you learn that it's your turn to make one of these presentations, like, your first reaction is to try to get out of it. I'm supposed to be presenting. My first reaction is like, don't make me, I can't, I haven't done anything good in the past 2 years. I just don't really remember what happened during the pandemic. And then I said that to, Emily Overman here, and she said, me too. You know, it's like, you know, can we all get out of it? Do we have to do this? And then you learn that even if you my plan is just to say, this is what happened, and these things were successful. I think these things were less successful. This was interesting for this reason, but, you know, failed for that reason. And, you know, I can do it in a way that, I don't think, you would necessarily do in front of an audience like this, although I probably would at this stage of the game. But I think and it happens here every day too. One of the reasons that I came to really appreciate Pentagram was I just really enjoy doing, you know, being around people, being able to kind of just walk by one of the designers' desks and see something on their screen that's interesting. And that person might work for Eddie O'Para, or that person might work for Natasha Jen. And I could just say, geez, what typeface is that? Or what photographer is that? Or how did you do that? How did you do that? You know, that animation you've got running there. And I'd sit down and just explain it to me. Then I could wave someone over from my team who I think, you know, we're working on a problem. I said, here, this is, you know, take a look at this. This is really interesting. So that part of it is just like great. It's like auditing 9 master classes at once, 5 days a week. It's really great.
Which is powerful. I'm going to continue on something that we started to deal with, which is a little bit of creative tension, and move from the business and your team side to the business and the client side. You know, we're in a space where it's been a lot of change. How have you been thinking about and managing the creative tension between being in the room with the client, right? Which is so much a part of what those in this call, that we all kind of experience, to this space where you can be in the room with the client and that's okay, or you can't be in the room with the client and that's okay. Yeah. And where is the, you know, where's the tension today? What are you seeing in terms of that affecting the work and your engagement?
Yeah, great question. And I think it's something that, you know, I bet everyone on this call has thought about or talked about in a way. I remember, if you would have asked me in February 2020 what my opinion of video conferencing was, it was like my least favorite way to do design. Like if I heard that we were going to have to kind of be on a call,
we might even have you on record saying that.
Yeah, I know. Like, I just thought, oh, it's a terrible way. You know, it's just awful. I just hate that. Can't we go down there and just sit in a room and get this sorted out? Do we have to like do this artificial thing where everyone's on TV? And then, you know, March 16th rolled around, and by the end of that week, everyone like knew. I'm sorry, you're on mute. I'm going to share my screen. Can you see this? I'm going to try to go to full screen. Okay. Is it advancing? Can everyone see, does everyone see a big red screen that says what, that says, you know, today's date? You know, it's just kind of, you know, and then it was 2 years of that. And I think we got really good at it, quote unquote. Right. But, I found that one of the things that I got good at, that I think my team got good at, and then that when I looked around at my partners, they seemed to get good at it too, was, you know, you sort of realized that every discussion in a way had to turn into a deck, you know, a slideshow that would have 20 slides, 40 slides, you know, whatever number of slides it had. And that meant that everything had to have this certain linearity to it that, you know, that made everyone kind of reframe the conversation as, you know, a narrative, like a 3-act play, or kind of, you know, a rising and falling action. And then everything is leading up to a moment where you're trying to deliver to a kind of decision that you're trying to force. And sometimes I'm good at doing that kind of presentation when the right. when the moment's called for it. I did it for years and years and years. But other times you want to be in a room, you just want to walk into a room and have it papered with the exploration that you did.
Right.
And just and like, you know, there's an architect that I assume a lot of people have heard of named Frank Gehry, who we've done some projects with. And he has a way of working with clients that I think is just powerful and disarming and explains why he gets to design those buildings, which just, right. if you look on their face, they're completely risky and crazy looking, but he hates being in that room doing that presentation. And he will say to the most important client in the world, you know, okay, so we've looked at that screen. Can I just take you back in the studio and show some of the stuff we're working on? And then he'll like literally just walk around the models and say, we tried this first. And unless something's going on that I've never seen rehearsed, it really looks as if he simply is walking in. And right. the moment he walks in, the work is as it's happening at, you know, at 11:37 on a Thursday morning in LA. And he'll literally say, you know, one of the things with this model here is that it just seemed, you know, the weight of it seemed to be too much on the top. So what if we here, give me that knife. And he'll literally take part of the building apart and just do it right before people's eyes. And it's so, you know, it's the exact, you know, even though he is the classic capital S architect, right?
Right.
You know, he's been in The Simpsons, you know, he's that right. famous. But like, on the other hand, there's something so personal and disarming and inviting about, you know, feel you've been invited to participate in the design process with someone. And that's sort of what's so hard to do on Zoom. You know, you can't have that experience of being in the room and having that sort of give and take that you could get, watch someone's reaction. I mean, the thing that I used to, you know, clearly I love making speeches and I like the sound of my own voice to a fault, but right. I sort of like learned that in a meeting, you know, you're not going to persuade anyone to your point of view by talking louder and faster. That doesn't work. You know, you have to, now I just learned to like stop and say, I can see a lot of confused faces, or you look like you really hate this idea.
Right.
You really hate it. Tell me why. And we'll go from there. And people, you know, sometimes they say, you know, I just, you know, it really doesn't work for me. I just like my least favorite color. And I've learned something really interesting there. If that's
right.
You know, don't use that color. But I think, you know, you don't learn anything by making speeches. You learn things by asking questions. And I think Zoom rewards people's ability to kind of make speeches, if you ask me. And I think it really doesn't give you the opportunity to be in the room, have that give and take that I think can be so productive in the design process. So as we're coming back to work, one of the things we're doing is, you know, as we're working in the office here, more face-to-face time,
right.
just between me and my designers, me and my partners, my designers and their, you know, the designers get a chance to kind of exchange ideas. We get a chance to kind of exchange ideas. That's healthy. And then, you know, yesterday we made a trek out and sat face-to-face with a fairly new client that we're working right. with. And just being in the room with them and even looking around that room, looking at the things on the wall, looking at the books on the shelf, looking at the body language of who sat where, who stood up, who would get more animated in the conversation, right. who right. sort of sat back and kind of stroked their chin. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get any of that information. You get very little of that information on Zoom. And, you know, not having to get on a plane and fly for, you know, travel for 5 hours for a hour long meeting is a useful thing too. It is right. good for your health and it's good for the environment, obviously. So I don't think it'll ever go away. I just think it'll become one tool that we'll use along with others as we go forward.
Well, there's a moment of discovery, and you were talking about, you know, kind of pre-pandemic walking around and looking over a shoulder or seeing an idea happening and kind of finding something there. So as you know, I live in DC, so it is the capital of bureaucratic efficiency. Okay. And in that, I learned that our English alphabet has 26 letters, but there are countless combinations that we can put them together to amaze and confuse us all.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk to you about one that starts off with with a combination of FOIA. And for those who aren't steeped in that, it's a Freedom of Information Act, which gives you access to government information. And you and your team came up with a brilliantly crazy idea and project that you worked on. And I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it for a second. For those who are listening in, if you get a chance to check or Google this, Michael and his team took a document that the FBI had put together on internet slang and all of the combinations of letters and what they mean. And you took that very bureaucratic, efficient document and turned it into a beautiful gem. But talk a bit about how this crazy idea came up and how you took it and turned it into this wonderful moment.
I'd be happy to. In fact, I can hang on. Give me like literally 10 seconds. I'll bring one in and I'll hold it up. Okay.
I can give you 10 seconds in that. So as everyone sees, this is the beauty of Fireside. We can pick up and jump in right there. I surprised Michael to talk about this project. So we'll get a chance to see it firsthand. All right.
So every year, Pentagram does a holiday card that we send out to our mailing list just for fun. And like, you know, and in the past few years, between people being displaced from their usual addresses and print being potentially dead and everything being online, we weren't even sure we should do this. I did have this idea. And part of the motivation of the idea is the newest partner in our London, in our New York office is a designer who some of you may not may no name Matt Willey. And Matt was for years the art director of the New York Times magazine, and is, I think he's the best, one of the best typographers and living today, and a great type designer. If you've ever seen the TV show Killing Eve, he did the main titles for that. And he's just brilliant. And I thought, well, when I'd like to, you know, it was on me to kind of come up with a suggestion for what the holiday card could look like. And I said, okay, but do something that was based on typography. That would be nice. And I remembered when the Freedom of Information Act uncovered this document from the FBI, which happened about 5 or 6 years ago. There's a story in Time magazine, story in the Washington Post. And basically it was when the internet was a little bit newer, when Twitter was a newer thing. And appeared based on this document, which the FBI, I don't think has ever really commented on, is that someone at the FBI was told, you know, we need to really research things that are happening on the internet. And they use a lot of acronyms like, you know, LOL and ROTL, you know, and ROFL and BRB and stuff like that. And, you know, some of these might be sinister or something. So we need to kind of have a glossary of all these internet acronyms so we can understand what's happening, you know, in cyberspace. And so if this list is, the list I came back with has like 2,400, it's like 2,400 acronyms.
It's amazing how many.
It goes on for 80 pages. And like some of them are things you've heard of. And then other ones, like you think maybe someone, you know, some FBI agent had like a 14-year-old kid and said, you know, I'm on this team that's researching the internet. Can you like tell me what kind of acronyms you and your friends use? And that kid just made up a bunch of things, you know, and just said, here, hey dad, or hey mom, here's like, here's something we use all the time. And so at any rate, I sort of went through this document, picked out my, two dozen or so favorite ones, and then worked with Matt Willey to kind of just do this typographic kind of guessing game where on the front, it says, the FBI guide to internet slang. And then there's a little introduction at the beginning that sort of says it's from the FBI's intelligence research support unit, put together an 83-page glossary with 2,800 entries. It had LOL and OMG, but it also had ones that were more obscure, like IITYWTMWYBMAD. Anyone want to guess what that means? It means, if I tell you what this means, will you buy me a drink? Which evidently people say on the internet. So, and then there's something you can sort of guess. This is rolling on the floor for no apparent reason. This is some of them may know this one too, naked in front of computer. At any rate, the joy that I had with this was I said to Matt, let's come up with some custom typefaces for this exercise. And he was inspired by having seen a couple of news stories about FBI raids and the markings that FBI people use, the FBI agents use on their jackets as they kind of go into action. And what's weird is that there are these, you know, there doesn't seem to be any consistent brand standards for how the FBI writes those three letters, FBI, in the back of their jackets. Okay. And so he sort of extrapolated two typeface families from that, a sans serif one that's called Edgar and a slab serif one. Hang on a second. That's called Clyde, Edgar being J. Edgar Hoover, and Clyde being his longtime associate. The two of them were partners, both professionally and perhaps even romantically, some say. But at any rate, the whole thing kind of like goes together. And then, you know, the very last one is the list goes on like that. In the very back, it's sort of, if you want to try to guess, then you can, but then it explains what they all are there. And so this was sort of a self, you know, the only client I had was my 13 partners. And I knew even if they thought my idea was stupid, they'd appreciate Matt's talent. And Amy just put a link to it if you want to see it. And if you want a copy of it, there's a way to, we'll send you a copy. All you have to do is make a donation of any size whatsoever to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that fights for privacy. Privacy and transparency on the internet, and has been doing it for years. And we don't keep any of that money; we just pass it all on. You just make a donation to them, send us proof of the donation. The donation can be a dollar, $10, $100, 50 cents, whatever you want. We'll send you a copy if you want it. So, thank you for asking about that. I got to talk about typography and work and a little printed book too, in the midst of talking about all these big ideas. Yeah.
I wanted to give you, my friend, a little opportunity to practice your sharing to everyone else. So I figured we do that with a fun project that goes in. But your biggest project that you have in front of you is your daughter's wedding. So yeah. I think what you've given us today is just the beauty of your journey and the story and talking about how we evolve and think about success and the work that we do. Yeah. I hope it's been helpful for those who are listening about, you know, really getting into the inner workings of how you make your partnership work, because we all are working with partners in spaces in there. We're doing good work together. And yeah. I think, you know, you've had some great kind of stories to talk about what's unique to you, but also some things that I think other people can take away. And then how we engage with clients in our new world. Yeah. And it's really in the intersection of design and business. So I would love to give you the last word, my friend, if there's anything you have for our growing design business leaders, right? Because we see that this is a growing part of our economy and world. Any advice you have?
The only advice I would have, and I think, Benny, you sort of set it up really nicely in the way you you kind of articulated kind of the summing up. A lot of times people try to figure out what the difference is between design and art. And there are many differences, but one of them is that art is something you can do alone, basically. You can go off by yourself and create based on your own vision, your own imagination. If you choose to practice design in any form whatsoever, at any level whatsoever, in any style whatsoever, for any reason whatsoever, you're enlisting in something that's a social activity. You know, you will need collaborators, clients, partners, people at every level to kind of both support you and who will depend on you for support. And, you know, in a capitalist society, business is one of the ways we structure those relationships. You know, how much your client is going to pay you for the work you're doing, what you have to do in order to get paid, right? How much you're going to be paid by your boss, how much you as a manager will compensate the people that are contributing to your team, right? But I think people tend to reduce business to dollars and cents. And really, that's an important part of it. But just as important are the way we learn to modulate and have productive and even joyful relationships with people, that aren't merely productive, but actually bring energy and put some good in the world, right? And I think in a way, anyone talking about business and design is really talking, they're using that, the language of business as a way really to address these larger interpersonal and larger societal issues that I think comprise the context of the work that we inevitably have to do. And that's what makes this sort of conversation important. That's what makes this conference important. That's always been the very best thing about AIGA as an organization. That was why when I found out about it back in the 70s, I became such an enthusiastic supporter then. That's why I've devoted so much time to it. It really provided a framework for exploring what those relationships could be at their very best.
I think that's a great way to end our conversations today with Michael Beirut, designer, AIGA medalist, mentor, champion of industry and growth, lecturer and speaker at Yale, and most importantly, dad on the hook design for the wedding. Thank you.
Yeah, Michael. Wish you luck. It's I need it.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your sincerity and candor and humor in bringing that FBI project to life. Thank you for sharing that with us.
A pleasure, Benny. Thank you. This has been great. I really enjoyed it. Good luck, everyone. Enjoy the conference.
Enjoy the conference. Thank you all for joining us for this fireside chat. I look forward to catching you with you later during the conference and into tomorrow's conversation. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.